From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, misquoting Jesus, we talk with biblical scholar Bart Ehrman. His new book is about how the scribes who handwrote each copy of the New Testament in its first 1,500 years made accidental or intentional changes. The Lord's Prayer and some of the popular stories in the Gospels were changed over time by scribes. Ehrman once took the Bible literally. He was born again at the age of 15, but now he considers himself an agnostic. He chairs the Religious Studies Department at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews the new King Kong. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There's a bumper sticker that reads, God said it, I believe it. My guest Bart Ehrman's reaction to that is, well, what if God didn't say it? What if the book you take as giving you God's words instead contains human words? Ehrman is the author of the new book, Misquoting Jesus. It's about how the New Testament was altered by the scribes who handwrote each copy and in the process made intentional or unintentional changes. Ehrman chairs the Department of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's a scholar of the New Testament and the early church. He was born again at the age of 15 and studied at the Moody Bible Institute. Later, while attending Princeton Theological Seminary, he started to have doubts about the literal interpretations of the Bible. He now describes himself as an agnostic. Let's start with how the Bible was hand-copied for almost 1,500 years.
With the Bible, we're talking about a period before there was movable type. And so for books to be reproduced, they had to be copied by hand. And so all of the books of the New Testament and all of the books, in fact, from all of antiquity were reproduced by hand, which is a very slow, painstaking process. To mass produce a book in the ancient world meant that you would give the book to a company that did these things, and they might have five scribes there who would copy the book. And so the mass production, or the Kinkos of the ancient world, was the little scribal shop on the corner where you might have five guys doing this to make a living. So the books got copied out by hand, and copying a book by hand, of course, meant copying it one sentence, one word, one letter at a time, and that's not only a painstaking and slow process, it's also the process is open for mistakes to be made, either accidental mistakes as a scribe is just being careless, or possibly he's tired, or possibly he's inept. And sometimes scribes actually change the text intentionally. When they think the text ought to say something different from what it does say, they could change the text. And then once, of course, they changed the text, the change was made permanent because this was the copy then that somebody else would use who copied the text later.
Let's look at one of the classic stories in the New Testament that you say scholars say was changed in changed by scribes. And this is the story of the woman caught in the act of adultery. Tell the story as we know it.
Well, it's a terrific story. It's found in the Gospel of John, chapter 7 and 8. The Jewish leaders have caught a woman committing adultery, and they bring her to Jesus, and they set a trap for Jesus. They ask him, they say, according to the law of Moses, this woman should be stoned to death. What do you say? So Jesus is put in this predicament because if he says, no, have mercy on her, as you would expect him to say since he's been preaching a doctrine of love and mercy, if he says that, then he's breaking the law of Moses. But if he says, no, go ahead and stone her, then obviously he's violating his own teachings about love and mercy. And so what's he to do? Well, he stoops down and starts drawing on the ground, and he looks up and he says, let the one without sin among you be the first to cast a stone at her. And then he stoops back down and starts writing again. And slowly, one by one, all of her accusers leave until he looks up and sees that she's alone. And he says then to her, is there no one left to condemn you? And she says, no, Lord, no one. And he says, neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more.
Now, what's historically questioned in this story?
Well, it's the whole story is very. It's a very interesting story for a lot of reasons. Interpreters have puzzled over it over the years. For one of the leading questions is, if this woman was caught in the act of adultery, where's the man? Because according to the law of Moses, both of them are to be stoned to death, but apparently they've only come away with a woman. So there are interesting interpretive questions. The bigger issue is whether, in fact, this is a story that belongs in the Bible or not. As it turns out, even though this is the favorite story of people who read the Bibles and who make movies about the Bible for Hollywood, this story probably was not original to the Gospel of John. The earliest manuscripts we have of the Gospel of John don't have this story. And none of the Greek writing church fathers, the New Testament, of course, itself was written in Greek, none of the Greek writing church fathers who comment on the Gospel of John include it in their commentaries until the 12th century, so 1,200 years after the book itself was written. This shows that the early manuscripts simply didn't have the story. So then the question is, how did we get the story? Well, in the Middle Ages, apparently a scribe knew the story, had heard of the story someplace through somebody telling him the story, and wrote it down in the margin of a manuscript. And some other scribe came along and saw this story in the margin of a manuscript and then transferred it into the manuscript itself in the Gospel of John. And from then on, that manuscript got copied. And one of the subsequent copies of that manuscript was the copy that was used then by the King James translators when they translated the Bible, so that this story has become totally familiar to people who read English, but it wouldn't have been known at all to Greek-reading Christians reading the Gospel of John in the ancient world.
Can you explain a little bit more what might have led a scribe in the 12th century to add this story?
Well, it's a terrific story. In the Gospel of John, right at this point, Jesus is condemning his opponents for not judging one another fairly, by not having a right judgment. And this is a story that, in a way, encapsulates that idea that judgment is to be a righteous judgment, and that mercy is more important than judgment. And so this illustrates the point being made in John chapter 7 and 8. And I suppose a scribe was reading John 7 and 8 and thinking about it and thought, you know, this story I heard, in fact, fits right in here, and put it in the margin for it then later to be copied into the text.
I mean, did the scribes have that much freedom in the work that they could just add a story?
Well, it's shocking, but it's shocking to my students just how often the scribes would change their texts. We tend to think that in our setting today, when a book is produced, it's always the same book. So I can go out and buy a copy of The Da Vinci Code, and it doesn't matter what city in America I buy the copy, it's exactly the same copy, word for word the same. And so that's what we expect of our books. But in the ancient world, they didn't expect their books to be like that, because they knew that these things were always being copied by hand and that mistakes were always being made, so that the very first copy of a book probably had mistakes. And then the person who copied that first copied the mistakes and added some of his own mistakes. And then that third copy was itself copied, and its mistakes were replicated then down through the line. And so mistakes multiply through the copying process. Some scribes felt completely free to change their texts. And would add stories or take out stories, would add lines, take out lines. We know this happened. This isn't just speculation. The reason we know it happened is because we have these thousands of surviving manuscripts. And when you look at these thousands of manuscripts, the striking thing about them is just how different they are from one another.
So what are you suggesting here, that we should just like ignore that story of adultery, that story has less currency than other stories in the New Testament, or that we should just see that as a story that was added later and take it as that? I mean, how does that affect your reading of that passage in the Bible? What do you make of it?
Well, it's a very good question, and I think Christians who see the Bible as authoritative have to make a decision. What is it that they think is authoritative? Is the original text, as it was originally written, is that authoritative? If that's authoritative, we have a problem, because we don't have the original text in many instances. But on the other hand, does somebody want to ascribe authority to a text that was clearly and certainly added later to the Bible, such as the story of the woman taken in adultery? If you ascribe authority to these stories that were added later to the Bible, where do you draw the line? Does it mean that anybody can add something to the Bible and then it can count as Scripture? This strikes me as a very difficult theological problem that theologians probably need to work on a little bit, to tell people what actually is the Bible that's being trusted as the authoritative Scripture.
You say that scribes also often preferred the text to be easy to understand and non-problematic. What do you mean by non-problematic?
Well, sometimes, even today, when somebody will be reading a passage in the Bible, it'll be hard to understand, or it'll sound like it contradicts another passage, or it'll sound like it's theologically unacceptable. And so people will often put a question mark in the margin because they can't figure out what it means. Scribes had that same situation, but they had the benefit of being able to change the passage so that it wouldn't be a problem any longer. And that happened on a lot of occasions, where scribes would make a passage easier to understand rather than harder.
And you offer as an example of this in your book, Jesus meeting the leper.
Yeah, this is a terrific story in Mark chapter 1. In most of the English Bibles available today, the way the passage goes is there's this leper who comes up to Jesus, and so he has some form of leprosy. We're not sure what it is exactly, but so this leper comes up to Jesus and says, "If you're willing, you're able to make me clean." And the text then says, Jesus, feeling compassion for the man, said, "I am willing," and he reached out his hand and touched him, and he made him clean. In some of our earliest manuscripts of this passage, there's a change in the text that is really quite striking. In these other early manuscripts, instead of saying Jesus felt compassion for the man, so he reached out his hand and touched him, it says Jesus became angry and reached out his hand and touched him. And so scholars have to decide what the original text probably was. Did Mark originally say that Jesus felt compassion or that he felt angry? And the way the argument works might sound backwards to some people, but the way the argument works is that since becoming angry is the more difficult reading to understand, it's more likely to have been the original reading. The logic is you have to ask yourself, if you were a scribe changing the text, which text would you have been likely to have changed? If you had the text in front of you that said Jesus became compassionate, would you be likely to want to change that to say he became angry? Whereas on the other hand, if the text originally said Jesus became angry, would you be likely to change it to say he became compassionate? So as it turns out, there's other evidence that in fact is exactly what Mark originally said, that Jesus became angry, and then that opens up then all sorts of possibilities for interpretation. But the point that I'm making in my book is just that this problem exists in the first place.
Well, yeah, it's a completely different interpretation, isn't it? If you think that Jesus became angry when the leper spoke with him, as opposed to Jesus feeling compassionate.
Absolutely, it's a completely different view. And you know, one of the exercises I give my students here at Chapel Hill in my New Testament class is I have them read through the first six chapters of Mark's Gospel, and to do a kind of character analysis of who Jesus is. And they're really surprised, because in these chapters of Mark, Jesus does not come off as the good shepherd of the stained glass window. Jesus seems to be getting angry a lot. He ignores his family. He rips his followers away from their own families. He's associates with a wild man in the wilderness, John the Baptist. He himself is driven into the wilderness by the Spirit of God, where he does battle with the demons. He commands illnesses and he commands demons. He seems to be a very charismatic and powerful figure that isn't to be messed with. And this idea of him getting angry when this leper came up to him fits in perfectly well with the way Mark is portraying Jesus in these chapters.
How does it fit in?
Well, because in these chapters, whenever anybody questions Jesus' ability or authorization to heal, he gets upset. So the next story where this happens is in chapter 3. He's in a synagogue, and there's a man there with a withered hand. And the people are watching him to see what Jesus is going to do about it, because it's the Sabbath. And it says Jesus looked around with anger at them, and he told the man to come forward, and then he healed this man's hand. So once again, you have Jesus getting angry in the setting of a healing story. And throughout Mark's gospel, during healing stories, Jesus gets angry for a variety of reasons. And so this leper is the first instance of that.
My guest is Bart Ehrman, author of the new book, Misquoting Jesus. He chairs the Department of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Bart Ehrman, and he's the author of the new book, Misquoting Jesus, The Story Behind Who Changed the Bible and Why. He chairs the Department of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. You know, we're talking about how the scribes seem to have changed passages in the Bible for various reasons. And another reason that you offer is theological disputes, that there were theological disputes in different periods of history that may have affected how scribes relayed the story that they were transcribing in the Bible. And an example of that that you give is what Mark versus what Luke has to say about Jesus on the cross. What's the difference between the two stories?
Well, there are several differences between the two stories. So Mark's gospel is quite gripping, I think, because Jesus has been rejected by the leaders of his people. One of his own followers has betrayed him. Another follower has turned him in as a traitor. All the other followers have fled. Jesus is silent throughout the entire proceeding of being crucified. And at the end, when he's hanging on the cross, he says nothing until the very end, where he cries out, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," my God, why have you forsaken me?" And he dies. This is it's a gripping story of Jesus in complete agony and with hints of him actually doubting why he's going through this. When you read Luke's account of the same event, you have a very different portrayal. In Luke's account, Jesus isn't silent on the way to be crucified. He sees some women by the side of the road weeping for him, and he turns to them and says, "Daughters of Jerusalem, don't weep for me, but weep for yourselves and for the fate that's to befall you and your children." While being nailed to the cross in Luke's gospel, Jesus isn't silent. Instead, he prays, "Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing." While being crucified in Luke's gospel, as opposed to Mark, in Mark you have both robbers mocking Jesus. In Luke, one of the robbers mocks Jesus, and the other robber tells him to be quiet because Jesus hasn't done anything to deserve this. And then this robber turns his head to Jesus and says, "Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom." And Jesus replies, "Truly, I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise." This is very different. Jesus knows exactly what's happening to him. He knows why it's happening to him. He knows what's going to happen to him after it happens to him. And then the most telling thing of all is at the very end, rather than crying out, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Jesus in Luke's gospel cries out, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit," and he dies. So in Luke's gospel, what you have is a Jesus who's completely calm and in control until the very end, knowing perfectly well what's happening to him and why, as opposed to Mark, where Jesus is in complete anguish and in shock in the face of his crucifixion.
And you suggest that these two different interpretations of the story reflect theological differences of the time.
I think that Mark and Luke have different theologies of the cross. They have different understandings of what it means that Jesus died, and different understandings of Jesus' attitude going into his death. What's particularly striking is that scribes who copied these accounts sometimes changed the accounts to eliminate some of these differences. And some of the times they changed when they changed these texts, they did so because of theological issues in the scribes' own world that were going on. I can give you a couple of examples of this. One of the most interesting changes in manuscripts of Luke's gospel takes place just before this crucifixion scene, when Jesus is in the garden praying. In Luke's account, remember, Jesus is calm and controlled and is not bothered at all, except for two verses when Jesus is praying before his arrest. Jesus is off with his disciples. He sends them away. He just takes Peter, James, and John with him, and he goes off to pray. And in some manuscripts, we're told that he went into great agony, and he started sweating great drops as if of blood, and an angel came down to minister to him. Now, these verses sound very strange in Luke, because in Luke, Jesus isn't in great agony, but these verses portray him precisely as being in great agony. It's striking that these two verses are missing from our oldest and best manuscripts of Luke. It looks like scribes have added them in order to show that Jesus really did suffer. That's significant because when these verses were added in the second century was a time period when Christians were debating whether Christ actually could have suffered or not. If he was divine, if he was in some sense God, then he obviously couldn't really suffer. But some Christians said, no, Jesus had to suffer because Jesus was the Son of God whose suffering brought about salvation. And so if he didn't suffer, there's no salvation. And so it appears that some scribes who wanted to emphasize that Jesus really did suffer put in these two verses about him sweating blood.
But, you know, these differences between the Mark and the Luke versions are pretty big. I mean, whether Jesus was on the cross in a kind of transcendent way or whether he was suffering, that's a really vast difference, and the message you would take away from that would be really different, too.
Yeah, you know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John all were writing books that they thought had integrity as books. So that when Matthew wrote his Gospel of Matthew, he wasn't planning on you reading that next to the Gospel of Luke and interpreting what he had to say in light of what Luke had to say, because he might have been saying something, in fact, quite different. What people do, though, is they read all four of these books, and then they mash them together and pretend they're all saying the same thing. This happens, of course, every Christmas during a Christmas pageant, where people take the stories of Jesus' birth in Matthew and the stories of Jesus' birth in Luke and smash them together so that now you have the Christmas story. When in fact, when you read Matthew, he has a very different account from the account of Luke, both in the details of what's said and differences that are discrepancies that are impossible to reconcile with one another if you look at them carefully.
Bart Ehrman is the author of Misquoting Jesus. He chairs the Department of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of The Narrative of Sojourner Truth, an African-American Testament, part of Barnes & Noble Classics, available in stores and online. From Audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/Fresh Air. And from Universal Pictures, presenting Munich, directed by Steven Spielberg and starring Eric Bana, Daniel Craig, and Jeffrey Rush, in select cities December 23rd. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, biblical scholar Bart Ehrman tells us about his transition from born-again Christian to agnostic, and we talk more about his book, Misquoting Jesus. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews The New King Kong. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with biblical scholar Bart Ehrman. His new book, Misquoting Jesus, is about the ways in which the New Testament was changed by the scribes who hand-copied each edition. Many of these changes were accidental mistakes. Many were intentional revisions. Ehrman chairs the Department of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I want to get back to the passage that you were describing, in which there are two different versions of it in the Bible, where Jesus is on the cross, and in one version he is asking God why he has forsaken him, and in the other version he seems much more calm and transcendent. So where do the scribes figure into this discrepancy?
Scribes change their texts in almost every passage, and including in these passages, sometimes by trying to make these passages more alike, and sometimes by trying to modify some of the statements in these passages. One of the most famous changes in Luke's account of Jesus on the cross is his prayer for forgiveness. When he's being nailed to the cross, only in Luke's gospel you have this prayer, "Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing." Now, people today might think that he's praying for the Romans, who were after all crucifying him. But when you read Luke's gospel very carefully, it looks like Jesus, in fact, is praying for the people who were responsible for his death, who are the Jewish leaders. And in the early Christian church, that was the way the verse was interpreted. Early Christian interpreters thought that Jesus was praying for the Jews. This was a problem for many Christians, because in the second and third centuries, Christians had come to believe that God had not forgiven the Jews for anything they did to Jesus, that in fact God had destroyed the city of Jerusalem in the year 70 because he was punishing Jews for the way they treated his Christ. This is when you start getting these awful charges of Jews being Christ killers. Well, it's precisely during that time that Luke's gospel gets changed by scribes, and they changed it by taking out the prayer, so that in some manuscripts made in the second and third centuries, Jesus no longer prays, "Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing." And the reason for the change is pretty clear. It's because these scribes didn't think that Jesus ever did pray for forgiveness, and of course that God himself never had forgiven the Jews for what they did.
So is it deleted during some periods, then added again later?
Some scribes omitted it, and then later, if a scribe was copying the passage and they saw the prayer was omitted, occasionally a scribe might add it back in, or the scribe might just leave it as it is. So you end up with some manuscripts that don't have the prayer, some manuscripts that do have the prayer, and then you're left with a historical decision. Did Luke originally have it, or did Luke originally not have it? And so then you have to, you know, the scholars argue which form of the text was the older form of the text. And in this case, there's not much doubt. Originally, Luke had the prayer, and some scribes took it out.
Let's look at another passage in the Bible that you question, and that is the Lord's Prayer as we know it, the popular version of the Lord's Prayer.
Right. This is one of those passages that occurs in two different versions in the New Testament. It's a passage that's found in the Gospel of Matthew, and it's found also in the Gospel of Luke. This is one of those places where the two passages, the passage in Matthew and the passage in Luke, disagree with one another with respect to the wording of the text. So that when you read, if you were to read Luke's version of this thing, you'd be surprised because it doesn't sound like the version that you know from the Gospel of Matthew. When you read Luke's version, it goes like this. This is from Luke chapter 11. "Father, hallowed be your name. May your kingdom come. Give us each day our daily bread, and forgive our sins, for we forgive our debtors, and do not lead us into temptation." And that's it. If you're familiar with the Lord's Prayer, it sounds like about half of it is missing, and in fact, it is missing. Matthew gives the fuller version of the Lord's Prayer, but even Matthew doesn't give us the Lord's Prayer as people say it today. Matthew's form of the Lord's Prayer ends by saying, "Do not lead us into temptation, but deliver us from evil," and that's the end of the prayer. What's happened over the years is when scribes were copying Luke's version of the Lord's Prayer, it would sound truncated to them, just as it does to us. And so they would change what Luke had to say by adding phrases from Matthew so that when scribes got done with the prayer in Luke's version, it sounded very much, almost identical, in fact, to Matthew's form of the Lord's Prayer. This is a kind of change that scholars have called harmonization, when scribes would take two accounts in two different Gospels and harmonize with one another so they don't stand at odds with each other anymore.
What's the earliest version of the Bible you've ever read or read a translation of? I know you can read several languages, so can you read Aramaic or Greek?
Yeah. The earliest copies we have are in Greek, and the earliest piece of a manuscript we have dates from around the year 125, so probably about 30 years after after the Gospel of John was written. We have this small fragment. It's about the size of a credit card. It's in the John Rylands Library in Manchester, England. And it has a few verses of John chapter 18 written on the front and on the back. And so, so I've held this thing in my hand and read it. It's really quite remarkable. As time goes on, we start getting larger fragments and then entire books of the New Testament. And what's striking about these earliest copies we have is that they differ from one another a lot more than the medieval copies differ from one another. This shows that early on in Christianity, you don't have professional scribes copying the texts. Probably the people copying these texts were simply the literate people of the congregation. Most people, of course, in the ancient world were highly illiterate. And so if there was somebody in a Christian church who could read and write, they were the one that was sort of collared and told to copy us out a copy now of this gospel. And so they would do it. And they may not be skilled for that, and they probably ended up making a lot of mistakes as a result.
The translation of the Bible that's best known to us today is the King James Version. And you say that there are kind of unique problems involved with the King James translation. What are some of those issues?
Well, the one that's most directly related to my book is that the King James translators had access only to late medieval manuscripts of the Bible when they were doing their translations. These late medieval manuscripts are different in many ways from the earlier manuscripts that have been discovered since the 17th century when the King James translators were at work. So that now we have much older and many more and much better manuscripts available to us, so that we know that there are passages that the King James translators included that weren't originally in the Bible. One of the key examples is one of the more interesting stories actually in the history of Bible translation. There's only one passage in the entire New Testament that explicitly affirms the doctrine of the Trinity. In other words, that explicitly states that even though there are three persons in the Godhead, there's only one God. This is a passage in 1 John chapter 5, verses 7 and 8, where you can read in some translations, like the King James Bible, there are three that bear witness in heaven, the Father, the Word, and the Holy Ghost, and these three are one. Well, that's an explicit statement of the Trinity, and without that explicit statement, you have to fish around throughout various texts of Scripture to come up with the idea that there's a Trinity, a Godhead made up of three persons, even though the Godhead is one. When the Bible first got published in Greek in the 16th century, the first publisher to come out with a copy of the Greek New Testament was an editor named Erasmus, a famous humanitarian from Rotterdam. And when he published his Greek New Testament, he did not include this verse. And this sent the theologians crazy. They started accusing him of heresy. They said that he's trying to get rid of the doctrine of the Trinity. They tried to ban his book, all because he left out this one explicit reference to the Trinity. Erasmus replied that he hadn't found it in any Greek manuscripts, that it was in the Latin Bible, the Latin Vulgate, which had been used by medieval scholars through the ages, but it wasn't in the Greek manuscripts. And he challenged them and said that if you can produce a Greek manuscript that has this in it, I'll include it in my next edition. And so, as the story goes, they actually produced a Greek manuscript with it in it. In other words, they had somebody copy out the Greek New Testament by hand. When they got to this point, he inserted the verse in Greek and then completed this edition, this manuscript. They turned it over to Erasmus, and he was true to his word. He, because it was found now in a Greek manuscript, he included it in his next edition. And as it turns out, that was the edition that was at the basis of the King James translation. So that's why that verse about the Trinity is found in the King James Bible, simply this kind of accident of history.
My guest is Bart Ehrman, author of the new book, Misquoting Jesus. He chairs the Department of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Bart Ehrman. He's the author of the book Misquoting Jesus, The Story Behind Who Changed the Bible and Why. And Bart Ehrman is the chair of the Department of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. Now that you have written this book about how scribes have changed the Bible over the years, that also a book that also addresses some of the discrepancies between the different Gospels in the New Testament, what does the Bible mean to you now? I mean, when you were a young man and you were an evangelical Christian, the Bible was the inerrant Word of God. You no longer believe that. What does the Bible mean to you? You still spend your time studying it and teaching it, so it must still mean a lot to you.
Yeah, well, it is. It is very important to me, and I think to our society. Even as our society moves either toward or away from religion, the Bible continues to be, of course, the best-selling book in the English language, and it's a huge cultural historical artifact. My view of the Bible is that it lies at the very heart of our form of civilization, and you can't understand our form of civilization without understanding the Bible. So that I don't look on it purely as a religious book. I look on it as absolutely fundamental to our form of civilization. What I personally think about the Bible is that the Bible is made up of a large number of books written by a large number of authors who all had spiritual insights, and these insights don't agree with one another. There are differences among them. Sometimes they actually contradict one another. John's view of Jesus isn't the same as Mark's view of Jesus, and it's not the same as Paul's view of Jesus. The book of Revelation doesn't agree with Paul. I mean, you can just go down the line. There are very marked differences among these various authors, but they all felt that they had a message, and this message is still worth hearing today. The various messages are worth hearing today. I don't think we hear the messages very well when we pretend that all the authors of the New Testament or of the entire Bible were saying the same thing. In fact, they're all saying very different things, and it's important for us to recognize what these differences are if we're to understand these books.
How do you resolve, finally, the differences between the different Gospels? And how do you resolve it historically or in a literary or religious way?
Well, my view of it is that we should not try to resolve the differences, that we should let the differences stand, that Mark was writing to a particular audience at a particular time for a particular reason, and it's worthwhile seeing what that time, purpose, and reason were. And Mark may have a message for the modern day, and it may not be the same message that Luke has for the modern day. Luke was writing at a different time for a different purpose, different reason, different audience. I think one needs to read Luke for what Luke has to say and what Mark for what Mark has to say, and all of the authors for what they have to say, recognizing them as people who have spoken to Christians down through the ages, and can still speak today. But the message they speak today won't be the same message they spoke to their audience in the first century, because we're different people from the people they were writing to. We have different assumptions about the world, different beliefs, different practices, different perspectives, different worldviews, and all of that has to be taken into account when we read these books.
In a recent article, you wrote that you consider yourself an agnostic now. What was the turning point for you from actually deciding that that's what you were, an agnostic?
It was a long process for me because, I had gone from being a fairly social-oriented Episcopalian to being an ultra-conservative evangelical. I guess basically I was a fundamentalist for several years. But then as my view started changing, I moved into liberal Christianity, and then I started doubting just about everything, not just the Bible, but even the things the Bible talks about. I had an experience when I taught at Rutgers University where I was teaching a class called The Problem of Suffering in the Biblical Traditions, where we dealt head-on with how the Bible explains the problem of misery and suffering in the world. And this got me thinking about problems of suffering. And eventually, after thinking about issues for years and years and knowing the problems in the Bible— And knowing that my faith had been rooted in the words of the Bible, which I couldn't trust any longer because I wasn't sure we even had the words, all of these things combined to eventually make me think that maybe I didn't believe anymore. And so it was only 7 or 8 years ago, I think, when I started calling myself an agnostic. But as I tell people who ask, I'm a happy agnostic. In other words, I think that, in fact, what I understand about the world now is better than what I understood when I was an evangelical Christian, and I have a happy life. So it's not a sad thing necessarily.
In what way is your understanding now better?
Well, it's better because I no longer believe something that I know to be false. The Bible, the words of the Bible are not the inerrant words from God. There are discrepancies in the Bible that cannot be reconciled, and we don't even have the original words themselves. And so basing one's life on words that we don't even have doesn't seem like the best way to go.
What do you think in the current political debate, when you hear people quote the Bible to defend or to explain their views on the issues of the day, whether that's, you know, abortion, war, homosexuality?
Well, I usually find it extremely frustrating because knowing the Bible well, I realize that they're quoting a particular passage when there are other passages that take just the opposite point of view. And so quoting the Bible as an authority ends up being somewhat disingenuous because it's a rhetorical move designed to win an argument. The Bible seems to get quoted a lot in the Congress for as a justification for going to war, or it gets quoted in debates over gay rights or abortion rights. And I think that, in fact, that's simply ripping passages out of context in order to justify one's own point of view. The reality is the people in the ancient world didn't have our view of abortion or homosexuality or Western imperialism. These are our points of view. And to quote an author writing 2,000 years ago who didn't have these points of view, I think doesn't really work.
As an agnostic, what does Christmas mean to you?
Christmas is still, I have to admit, is still my favorite time of year. I love Christmas trees, and I love the giving of gifts, and I love the cheer of the season. I'm completely optimistic about it, unlike a lot of people I know who actually dread the season. I love the season. And as with most religious truths, I more or less demythologize the meaning of Christmas. So that, the ultimate meaning of Christmas, the Christmas story, God sends his son into the world for salvation, and eventually his son is going to give his life for the sake of others. This is a religion about giving, and I think it's a lesson for all of us that, in fact, we all need to be more giving, and this is a season whose religious truths teach us that.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Bart Ehrman is the author of Misquoting Jesus. He chairs the Department of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Coming up, our film critic David Edelstein gets emotional about a big ape. This is Fresh Air. Following the success of The Lord of the Rings, the New Zealand-based director Peter Jackson could have made any movie he wanted. He chose to remake his favorite film, the 1933 monster classic King Kong. The original Kong was high-tech for its time. Willis O'Brien, the father of stop-motion animation, turned an 18-inch model into the eighth wonder of the world. Film critic David Edelstein has a review of the new Kong.
Step right up, folks, and feast your eyes on the eighth wonder of the world. No, it's not King Kong. It's Peter Jackson's ego. Yes, folks, this ego belongs to the man who took on J.R.R. Tolkien and won. And Jackson has now remade the classic monster movie King Kong as, I kid you not, the greatest interspecies love story of all time. All hucksterism aside, this Kong will soak up your biggest hanky. It's cornball, it has clunky dialogue, it's really long, and it's just about irresistible. The structure is nearly identical to the great 1933 original, but that one was lean and unfussy, even rather stoic. Jackson's, on the other hand, is endlessly show-offy. It's a three-ring circus of computer-generated effects with a big fat dollop of Cecil B. DeMille emotional shamelessness. Jackson has made a couple of smart alterations. The blonde actress, Ann Darrow, is no longer a bimbo. As played by Naomi Watts, she's a goody-two-shoes with a social conscience, a vaudeville performer who can barely afford to eat in the Great Depression, but won't debase herself by working in a grindhouse. Luckily, she gets waylaid by the two-bit impresario Carl Denham, played by Jack Black, who needs her to replace the leading lady who left his new picture in the lurch. Denham wants her to hop on a ship bound for the mysterious, fog-shrouded Skull Island, and his gung-ho optimism is just what our melancholy, fatalist heroine needs.
Anne, I want you to imagine a handsome explorer bound for the Far East.
You're filming in the Far East?
Singapore. On board ship, he meets a mysterious girl. She's beautiful. She's fragile, haunted. And she can't escape the feeling that forces beyond her control are compelling her down a road from which she cannot draw back. It's as if her whole life has been a prelude to this moment. This fateful meeting that changes everything. And sure enough, against her better judgment,
she falls in love.
Yes.
But she doesn't trust it. She's not even sure if she believes in love.
Really?
If she loves someone, it's doomed.
Why is that?
Good things never last, Mr. Denham.
I like Jack Black, but the increasingly despicable Denham needs some period 30s flair, and Black is too much of a modern hipster. And Adrian Brody is a little dewy sensitive for my taste as Denham's screenwriter, who becomes an improbable action hero. But Naomi Watts, she's pure gold, spark plus heart. Peter Jackson couldn't have computer-generated a lovelier heroine. Needless to say, he computer-generated everything else. When the ship pulls into the Skull Island harbor, the vast vertical rock face tells you you're back in Lord of the Rings country, where the heights are higher and the abysses more abysmal. When we first see Kong, he doesn't lumber in on two legs. He leaps in on all fours. And he's very fast. The most obvious way that Jackson ups the ante is by upping the pace, which is even more headlong than in Jurassic Park. The showpiece is a scene in which the giant gorilla battles three hungry T-Rexes while holding Anne, while plunging into a mammoth gorge. I could rave about the dinosaur stampede and the giant white worms that suck men whole into their big squishy maws, but let's get back to our leading ape. After he makes off with Anne, he enjoys knocking her down with his giant index finger and watching her scramble to her feet. And when she tells him to cut it out, he shakes the theater with his roar. He rips out a few trees, and he beats his chest in masculine defiance. But he knows it's not a battle he can win. The animators had a real performance to work from, by Andy Serkis, who did similar duties as Gollum in Lord of the Rings. Serkis makes Kong's emotions remarkably fluid. The giant gorilla even has spells of depression. A lonely monarch, he stares out from his cliff throne at the sunset. By now he's made Anne feel protected against all the other giant monsters. So when Brody's puny human hero shows up to liberate her, she hesitates. He can't make her feel as safe as Kong does. and he can't need her as much. Their last scene, atop the Empire State Building, is gloriously florid. It leaves Titanic far behind. Teenage girls will bang their heads on the seatbacks in front of them. Grown men will weep at their own inadequacies. Hell, I did. Giant gorillas will beat their chests in vindication. There's no way that Anne and Kong could be anything but just, you know, friends. But this is the first King Kong that makes you dream of all the other possibilities.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Next week, he'll review holiday movies and give us his 10 best list. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, and Sam Brigger. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Delacorte Press, publisher of Embracing the Infidel, Stories of Muslim Migrants on the Journey West by Behzad Yaghmayan. And from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Tommy Lee Jones. He directed and stars in the new film, The Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada. And we talk with the Wall Street Journal's air travel columnist, Scott McCartney, about recent changes in the airlines and how they'll affect holiday travel. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.